I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. Donald Trump is riding high on a wave of populist rhetoric, but his candidacy is causing ripples in the Republican Party. He's taken flak from fellow GOP presidential candidates Lindsey Graham, Rick Perry, and former Florida Governor Jeb Bush. He's fired a campaign staffer for questionable Facebook posts, but he's also come out swinging, saying he has enough money to finance a campaign even if the party doesn't back him. And he's not backing down from comments about immigration. But did Donald Trump's wave finally break last night? What do you think? Join us for the Friday News Roundup. We're taking your calls. 1-866-338-5252. I'm joined by Frank Torres. He's the editor of the Orlando Political Observer. Hi, Frank.
Good morning.
And Retta Peoples, columnist for the Florida Sun. Hi, Retta.
Good morning.
And Jason Garcia, associate editor with the Florida Trend magazine. Hi, Jason.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, let's talk about Donald Trump. Is he a political genius or is he just a prankster? He knows certainly how to turn bad publicity into good. After his phone number was sent out by Gawker, he turned that into a political ad. But is he just doing it for the publicity? Let's hear from Trump. Here he is on the debate stage last night.
This country is in big trouble. We don't win anymore. We lose to China. We lose to Mexico, both in trade and at the border. We lose to everybody.
And now let's hear from Jeb Bush, former Florida governor.
Mr. Trump's language is divisive. I want to win. I want one of these people here, or the ones at 5 o'clock, to be the next president of the United States. We're not going to win by doing what Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton do each and every day, dividing the country.
Well, did you watch the debate last night? What did it tell you about the candidates? Is there room in the tent for the likes of Donald Trump? And how did Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio compare? Be part of the conversation. You can join us by calling 1-866-338-5252. Jason Garcia, I want to start with you. You made a comment last week on the show about Jeb Bush. You said he's kind of expected to be the adult in the room. Is that what you saw last night?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what you saw. And that clip you played was a perfect example of him trying to position himself above the fray and the person, particularly when it comes to Donald Trump, that sort of treating him as a sort of a benign character and not, you know, engaging in sort of the Rand Paul way of attacking, but more treating it like, you know, someone who he is above this and he is the adult. He is the guy to lead the Republican Party out of sort of whatever circus act might be happening right now.
Kind of hard for those candidates to get away from Donald Trump, though, when half of the time it seemed like the compeers for the debate were asking them to speak directly to Donald Trump or talk about stuff that he'd said.
Right, yeah. He's a magnet for publicity, and that shows no signs of slowing down right now. You're right. He sucked almost all of the oxygen out of the room last night, although a lot of that seemed to be, you know, Fox News going really hard after him.
Mm-hmm. How much of what goes on that debate stage is for the benefit of voters, though, and how much is kind of for the benefit of the party and funders?
Well, this early in a race, it's hard to know how many voters are really paying attention. You know, I don't think there's a lot of value in terms of, you know, sort of finding out stuff you don't know about them. Most of them, especially with debates like this where the time frames are so rigidly, I think some candidates spoke for about 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
What it is valuable to see is you see people in these sort of high pressure, momentous situations. You get a chance to evaluate how they react, who loses their temper, who's cool, who's, you know, how they interact interpersonally, that sort of thing.
Well, Retta Peoples, in the past, Jeb Bush has said his party needs to do more to broaden its support amongst minority voters, particularly Hispanics. Did you see some of that on display from Jeb Bush last night?
I saw a little bit of that on display last night. I think the party really does need to do a lot more to engage minority supporters. They are out there, you know, but they've got to reach out to the African-American and the Hispanic community a little bit more in order to really, you know, solidify their base.
Mm-hmm. And what about primary candidates, you know, reaching out to minority voters? If just moving beyond Jeb Bush, what did you hear from the other candidates last night?
Well, of course, we heard that Ben Carson can separate twins. You know, that's pretty good. But as far as hearing about the minority community and what can happen with that, the changes that need to happen within the minority community, I didn't hear a lot of that.
Mm-hmm. Ben Carson made some interesting comments, too. He sort of sidestepped the race question a little bit, I think.
He did. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. He did. He stayed away from that, you know, which is, you know, I think is definitely not a good thing. But, you know, Ben Carson is Ben Carson. So we'll see what happens with that. Google, you know, said that the most Googled people after the debate was Ben Carson and Donald Trump.
Right.
So we'll see how that shakes out.
Okay. Frank Torres, what part does polling play, and are there other factors at play in deciding who gets to debate? Because, of course, we had kind of a starting act, as it were. We saw the likes of Carly Fiorina, former Texas Governor Rick Perry on that stage. And then that very crowded main stage, and as it's been pointed out, a lot of those candidates didn't get a lot of airtime.
No, it was just a crowded field, and you had to do the most with the time you had. I think that in retrospect, especially after the boom she's gotten since that first early debate, that being in that second field might have, in fact, been a blessing in disguise for Carly Fiorina. I expect her numbers to go up. She was definitely a cut above the rest in that otherwise pretty dull field in that first debate. But, you know, I believe the next debate will incorporate even more polling to get a larger picture of who's really competitive and who's not. And it's just constantly taking the pulse of the electorate to try to make sure that you have the most viable candidates on stage. But a very good first product last night, a very entertaining first product for sure last night from that first Republican debate.
Do they winnow down the candidates a little bit? Are we going to see fewer on stage next time around?
We're going to see if anybody was seriously hurt by last night's debate. I expect some in that first 5 o'clock second tier competition to take some serious hits. I don't see George Pataki getting a lot of traction. I don't see Lindsey Graham getting a lot of traction, as well as the former governor of Virginia, Gilmore. Mm-hmm. Those are guys that are already on the ropes, already on life support. You might see some of them drop off, and who knows? You might even see more people jump in. Nothing's out of the picture at this point.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking about what happened with that first GOP debate last night. I'm going to take a call now. We're going to Daytona Beach. Teresa from Daytona Beach, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm 75 years old. I have watched a lot of debates. My feeling is Donald Trump is a plant. So many people, Americans, are fooled so easily. Donald got into it. He got into it to draw attention to this whole rigmarole, all of these debates, or kind of like a wrestling match, a build-up. He is a plant, and he's there to make Jeb Bush look good, to play off of him.
That's an interesting comment, Teresa. What makes you think that from, you know, having seen last night's debate? I mean, there seemed like a little bit of back and forth between Jeb and Donald, but they kind of complimented each other a little bit. There was a question from one of the moderators, you know, did you call Donald Trump a clown and a buffoon? Jeb said no, and Trump seemed quite thankful for that afterwards.
Well, of course Jeb's going to say no, because he wants that 20% that's like Donald. So he's going to feed into that base and try to get them. Donald is a corporate, I don't want to use a nasty word. He'll play both sides. He doesn't care. He's an egomaniac. This is all pre-planned. People, wake up. You are being had.
Thank you so much for your call, Teresa. Well, what do you think about that panel? Rita, do you think there's some merit in that idea that Donald Trump is kind of there to make some of the other candidates look good, whether it's Jeb Bush or whether it's some of the others?
Excuse me. Absolutely. I agree with her. I think that you know, Donald Trump is an excellent marketer. He's out there. He's pushing his brand. Whether or not he's going to be president, you know, I would have to go with a big fat no.
Mm-hmm. Chris Salitzer, who writes the Fix column for The Washington Post. This week he wrote a column titled, Boy, Was I Wrong About Donald Trump, talking about those polls, the fact that he'd written earlier that he thinks Donald Trump isn't in it for the long haul. Can he keep his momentum up? What does this all mean? If you want to weigh in, 1-866-338-5252 is the number to call. We're standing by. Jason Garcia, you were of the opinion last week that Donald Trump isn't really going to, you know, stay the distance, but are you going to have to write a Boy, Was I Wrong column?
I still don't think so, and I'm certainly not going to write it for a while yet. I would have been a bit more worried or / intrigued about Donald Trump if we'd seen more of an attempt last night to sort of appear presidential and something a little bit more subtle or graceful than sort of just the bombastic bomb thrower he's been. But I don't think you saw that. I mean, the Donald Trump of last night, the Rosie O'Donnell crack, I made lots of money in Atlantic City. I took advantage of the bankruptcy laws. I mean, that's all fits with what he's been doing up to this point. And he's attracting a lot of attention because of his celebrity, and he has clearly tapped into sort of an angry vein among some voters. But there's just a limit to how far that carries, and particularly when it comes down to when people get to the point of actually deciding on this is the guy I want in the White House. And I think I don't see him progressing beyond this point.
Well, what do you think? 1-866-338-5252 is the number. Did you watch last night's debate? Were there winners and losers? Doesn't it even matter? Let me ask this question to the panel. First of all, Frank Torres, did you see a clear winner and some clear losers from that primetime debate last night?
You know, my clear winners, whether it was a good winner as far as the future of the country or not, Donald Trump did get the most screen time. He had a lot of people tuning into the debate that wouldn't normally tune into the debate. Did he add a circus element? He absolutely did, but gee whiz, he certainly stuck to his ground and showed that he can mix it up in that seasoned field of political veterans. Other winners include Marco Rubio, who really stretched his story out there on a national stage. We're all familiar with, you know, his upbringing and the modest background of his parents. I thought he did very well. And I thought it was, as far as the losers go, I think Rand Paul didn't do too well last night. He got knocked around by Trump. He had a terrific exchange with Chris Christie, which I thought he got the short hand of. And even though a lot of people liked what they heard, I thought Ben Carson had a tough time last night because he was off screen for almost 30 minutes, and he even joked about it afterwards. Mm-hmm. So I think as far as the winners and losers go, I think that's how you have to, you know, mark it up.
Rita Peoples, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that there was some clear winners and clear losers. I think as far as Donald Trump is concerned, he definitely got the most screen time, like Frank said. You know, the loser, Ben Carson, I think Scott Walker kind of came in the middle in that. So it's interesting how this debate shakes out and then what we're going to see in the coming months.
And Jason Garcia, your thoughts? Anybody really stuck out from the field there?
Well, the thing about debates, right, is it takes a few days to really figure out, you know, what sort of impact it's had among voters. You know, a lot of times sort of what we might think in our sort of instant takes aren't necessarily how it plays out. That said, I think Marco Rubio is getting some of the strongest reviews, and this sort of plays into Marco's strengths. He is very good when he has time to prepare sort of with a stump speech or for certain questions, you know, that you can sort of easily anticipate, such as the first question he got about comparing himself to Jeb Bush. When he has that is him at his best. Rhetorically, he is probably better than everyone else. So these sorts of debates, particularly ones where there's very limited amount of interaction and sort of depth, is where Marco really excels. And I think he did well last night.
1-866-338-5252 is the number. We're going to go to a break, but when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about the debate, and we'll talk about some Florida politics too. The Florida Senate, just days before reconvening for a special session, has drawn up their proposed map. They'll meet in Tallahassee next week to hash out the details. Some big changes to Corrine Brown's District 5, also Daniel Webster's district in Central Florida. How are those changes going to shake out? And of course, over on the West Coast, it looks quite good for Charlie Crist to make a comeback too. 1-866-338-5252. Join the conversation. We'll be back in a minute.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Florida Hospital. What is it that makes life so amazing? It's each member of the community doing our part to make life better. Because here in Central Florida, we're not just citizens, we're neighbors, we're friends, we're family, we're everything that makes life amazing.
Good morning, and thanks for joining us on your Friday morning. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, analysis of the first GOP debate. The Senate puts off unfinished business as it leaves for August recess, and a federal appeals court blocks a Texas voter ID law.
Stay tuned for the Diane Rehm Show. That begins at 10 o'clock on 90.7 News.
Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. I'm joined in the studio by Frank Torres from the Orlando Political Observer, Rita Peoples, who writes for the Florida Sun, and Jason Garcia from Florida Trend magazine. Just staying with that debate from last night for a minute, Peter Schorsch, writing in St. Peter's blog this week, says Jeb needs Marco out of the way if he's to beat Donald Trump. And if he's to beat Scott Walker in Iowa, for that matter. Last night, from what it seems, Marco Rubio had a pretty good showing. So is it a matter of one of them having to drop out? Frank Torres, what are your thoughts?
I don't think we're at that point yet. I think things will play out as they will. There's been a lot of buzz that that Rubio's campaign has been getting beat pretty convincingly by Jeb here in Florida, and one of these guys will probably win the state unless there's a lot of unforeseen events, and the winner of that will go ahead and move on. I do see Jeb with all the momentum right now. We'll see if Marco will get a bump after that debate performance last night. But for both of these two guys to advance deep into this contest would be very unusual, especially since they're trying to pull support from the same amount of from the same pool of voters and donors.
Mm-hmm. And back on the campaign trail, Marco Rubio was at a Southern Baptist conference this week, as was Jeb Bush. Jason Garcia, just how important is that kind of conservative Christian political bloc?
Oh, it's hugely important in a Republican primary, and I think that's why you saw probably Marco's most difficult moment in the debate last night was when he was pressed on the idea of supporting abortions in cases of rape, incest, and health of the mother. Mm-hmm. I think Marco had said, I've never said that I supported that, even though he has co-sponsored legislation that way. And what's happening there is, particularly in primaries, they become races to either extreme, right, to the left on the Democratic Party, to the right in there. And so evangelical voters are an enormously important block, and the last thing any of these guys wants to be done is seen as supporting any kind of abortion rights whatsoever, you know, right now. In October, it'll be a different sound, or October 2016. But
right.
So, yeah, it is a very influential block, and you're seeing a lot of these guys do what they can to try and court that mm-hmm. faction.
Mm-hmm. Reader Peoples, what are your thoughts on this issue? Do you think it's going to be difficult for some of these candidates to maybe walk back from some of the stuff they might say in the primary debates?
Absolutely. I think some of the things that they're saying, you know, is going to come back to haunt them if they don't fall out of the clown car, you know, as we go down, you know, these next few months. It's going to be hard to retract certain things, just like Marco Rubio, you know, as you said, that they're going really far right with the abortion situation and those issues. And I think that may come back to haunt Marco Rubio.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to stay with politics, and let's talk about what's happening in state politics here. 1-866-338-5252 is the number to call if you want to weigh in on what's happening with redistricting. As you might have heard, Corrine Brown has filed a lawsuit to stop the redrawing of that map. Her district is one of the most changed in this proposed map from the Florida Senate. Let's hear a little bit from Corrine Brown. Here she is speaking outside the Orange County Courthouse yesterday.
We ain't talking about Republicans or Democrats. We're talking about representative government. We need to make sure that we have an opportunity to elect candidates of our choice.
Well, big changes to Corrine Brown's District 5. As I said, it's going to move basically from a kind of a vertical orientation. It's going to sort of pivot and move east to west across the top of the state there. Reader Peoples, do you think Corrine Brown has a point about the new district violating those voting rights? I mean, are minority voters going to get the short shrift with these new boundaries?
No, absolutely not. You know, I think her district looked like a spilled glass of water. I mean, it just ran all over the place. It was a definition of gerrymandering. And I think we definitely need a new map. We mm-hmm. have to have a new map.
Jason Garcia, that proposed map from the Florida Senate, that's obviously kind of the draft plan at this stage. How changed do you think it's going to be by the end of the special session and by the time it finally wins its way through this long process?
Well, I think you'll definitely see some changes. There's already people in Leon County are upset that Leon County is now divided into. Obviously, you know, Corrine Brown is upset. In Orlando, you saw a number of Hispanic voters moved out of Alan Grayson's seat. So there'll be some debate about whether or not that's still a Hispanic access seat and should be a Hispanic access seat. So there'll certainly be some changes. By and large, though, I'm not sure if they'll make radical changes at this point, just because everybody is treating this so carefully with the court order hanging out there. I'd be surprised. Doesn't mean it won't happen for sure, but I'd be surprised if you saw major changes from what's being presented right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you're in a district that's being redrawn, 1-866-338-5252 is the number to call. Tell us what you think about this process. Are they going about this the right way, or are there still some kinks that need to be ironed out there? You mentioned the Hispanic you know, proportion of voters in that district from Alan Grayson there. Do you think we're likely to see a lawsuit from folks in that district too?
I don't know if you will see a lawsuit in that so much as you will see some discussion about it. You know, one difference there is it's a Hispanic access seat, but it was actually a white male that won it. So I'm not sure. I wouldn't necessarily expect a lawsuit. I imagine you'll hear a guy like Darren Soto, who is right now running for that seat, talking a lot about the need to have a Hispanic access seat. But as far as a lawsuit goes, I would doubt it.
Mm-hmm. Reader Peoples, there's some other kind of things opening up for various people who are pretty well known in the political world here in Central Florida. One of them, former police chief of Orlando, Val Demings, and there's a new Twitter account with her name on it, some saying basically, watch this space to see what I'm planning to do in the next little while. What are your thoughts on Val Demings? Could she make a comeback once these new maps are drawn up?
Absolutely. I think Val Demings would be perfect for the seat, the one that Daniel Webster currently holds. You know, I think she can definitely make a comeback. She's strong. She ran a really tight police department. And, you know, she's just got she's got the vigor. She's got it.
Mm-hmm. Having said that, though, Frank Torres, some of those campaigns she's run in the past couple of years haven't gone so well.
Yeah, and bless the chief. You know, she's a great woman, but I've been one of her toughest critics. And also her husband does a great job with the sheriff's department. But as far as running campaigns and as far as what's been going on behind the scenes, it's her congressional campaign was poorly managed. She was the only major Democrat to lose in 2012 when President Obama seemed to have won everything along with that sweep of Democrats. And her mayor campaign folded after a couple of months last year. So if she wants to be competitive in that seat, she's going to have to get together and hire some really good management. And as far as that incumbent, Daniel Webster, one of the most beloved lawmakers in the area, I wouldn't count him out regardless of what the numbers look like. I mean, we're talking about a guy who's universally respected and political pacifist. So we'll see how things go, and it's going to be a very interesting race to watch.
Mm-hmm. What about some of those other people who are kind of popping out of the woodwork too? I mean, we've got former governor of Florida, Charlie Crist, well known to pretty much everybody in Florida. He tried to make a comeback as the governor second time around, didn't work. Now he's looking at a congressional seat. Could that happen?
It could absolutely happen. You know, the way these maps dropped, they completely encompass where Charlie Crist is now, which is out there in Pinellas among his people, the most loyal of Charlie Crist supporters. If the maps fall where they will, the way they're proposed right now, he's going to go to Congress.
Well, let's talk a little more about Gwen Graham. I mean, she's up in North Florida. She could be a casualty of these new district maps. What does she run for if her district is no longer winnable?
You know, I think Gwen Graham is a terrific Senate candidate. I think she's definitely more exciting than Patrick Murphy, and I think she won't be afraid to trade blows with Alan Grayson. So I think that's something she definitely has to look at. She's got a terrific story. As far as Congress goes, we're just going to have to see where it goes, but it's definitely not an easy draw for her.
Jason Garcia, is that what you're hearing, Gwen Graham for Senate?
Yeah, there's a lot of talk about that. And I think she's actually, in one respect, she's sort of one of the obvious losers of redistricting because her seat is basically gone. But on the other hand, it sort of sets up a really interesting situation for her because the other thing you hear a lot about her is that she would like to be governor of Florida. So she's in a position now she can run for Florida Senate, right, or for U.S. Senate. And even if you know, even if Marco ends up coming back to that seat and that becomes a much tougher race for anyone else, she can run and lose and set herself up pretty well to run for governor again in a couple of years. Florida is such a large, expensive state to campaign in that it's very hard to get your name known. And one of the best ways to sort of set yourself up for the future is to run statewide and lose. Mm-hmm. And she's in a position where she can do that without really having given up anything because her congressional seat's basically been taken from her.
Well, just on that note, here's a thought. What about Marco for governor?
Oh, yeah. That's a lot of folks have been talking about that for months. I think I wrote something about that in Florida Trend before the last governor's race, that a number of people expect him to run for governor. Obviously, he won't do that if he's elected president. But aside from that, I think absent him winning the Republican nomination for president, I think he is very likely to run for governor in a couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's turn now to a story about Orlando lawyer Marco Mera. He, of course, is known for defending George Zimmerman. He's the former Neighborhood Watch volunteer who shot and killed unarmed black teenager Trayvon Martin in Sanford a few years ago. O'Meara has gone on to become a commentator on CNN. He's also now representing the family of Samuel DuBose. That's the Cincinnati man who was shot and killed by a police officer during a traffic stop. Let's hear from Mark O'Meara now. Here he is talking to 90.7's Amy Green this week.
I think the DuBose family would identify justice as a very specific reform policy at University of Cincinnati Police Department and throughout Ohio and throughout the country, so that when we look at a case like this and we look at a tensing, we'll say one day, remember that case years ago when that officer tensing did that horrible crime and how that hasn't happened since?
That's Mark O'Meara talking to 90.7 there. He says there's quite a lot of polishing to do, quote unquote, with the U.S. criminal justice system, particularly with regard to how minorities are handled and why they end up in the system more than they should. Well, what does it mean that the man who defended the shooter of an unarmed black teen is now representing the family of an unarmed black man shot by police? Is community engagement the answer to the problem of injustice that's led to the Black Lives Matter movement? And are police being unfairly maligned for just doing their jobs? You can join the conversation. We'd like to hear from you. 1-866-338-5252 is the number. 1-866-338-5252. Rita Peoples, I want to ask you, do you see the focus on the police and the protests that surround each of these incidents, Eric Garner, Michael Brown, Samuel DuBose, Walter Scott, having some kind of tangible result?
Absolutely. I think it's justified. You know, I think these things have been going on for so long, and now we're in the age of information. We're able to record these things. You know, there's apps. The ACLU has an app out there that you can record and send directly to them for justice. I think now we're being able to see mistreatment of certain police officers in the African-American community. I do think there's going to be some good results out of it.
And Sanford is arguably where this moment focusing on justice for the black community began, although it wasn't a police officer who was involved in that shooting. And that police department has taken steps to bring about a change in police tactics. They have more of a focus now on community policing. Are they taking the right steps here?
Absolutely. I think they're taking the right steps. I think, you know, most importantly, having the right team and having the right law enforcement officers on board who understand and respect the community is what's necessary to make this movement go into the next gear.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of that, Rita Peoples, is there enough momentum in the Black Lives Matter movement to carry that all the way through to the 2016 presidential election?
I think so. If it's handled properly, there is enough, gumption in this movement to make it go forward. One of the things that we see in crisis politics a lot is, the shifting of sympathy. And when the New York officer was murdered, it kind of took the focus away from the Black Lives Matter movement and shifted towards All Lives Matter. So I think that that movement has got to get back on track to, to justify what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Frank Torres, that All Lives Matter quote, I mean, that's kind of political kryptonite in some circles, though, isn't it? I mean, you've heard people say that and basically get booed off the stage in some situations.
Right. You know, you can't underestimate how carefully these issues have to, be handled and regarded. There has to be universal respect involved. You have to go in with everything with a very, open mind and a very tolerant disposition to listen to everything involved and to take in all the facts and to be very respectful of the emotions of everybody involved.
1-866-338-5252 is the number. What are your thoughts on the Black Lives Matter movement? Do you feel like incidents involving black men in the United States and the police, are they going to lead to some tangible results in terms of maybe some reforms, maybe some movement forward in terms of what's going on? Give us a call, 1-866-338-5252. Let's just stay with this issue of the police for the moment, turning now to a story about a Sarasota police officer. He was seen on video throwing food, apparently, at a handcuffed prisoner. The suspect was reported to be homeless. He was a man who was apparently arrested for trespassing at a convenience store while drunk. The police department says the officer, Andrew Halpin, resigned Tuesday this week, and that was before a police department investigation into the incident could be completed. Frank Torres, Sarasota was at one time labeled, quote, the meanest city in America for its treatment of the homeless. Do you get the sense that attitudes to homelessness are changing when it comes to the way law enforcement deals with them?
I think here in Central Florida, it's definitely changing. You've seen leadership, especially municipal leadership, like Orlando Mayor Buddy Dyer and Orange County Mayor Teresa Jacobs, as well as you know Orange County Sheriff Jerry Demings and Orlando Police Chief John Meenum, get behind supporting the homelessness. This is obviously one of the biggest municipal problems that has been taking over the city for the last 15 years, and they haven't been able to solve it. But I think you're seeing a lot of the community come together to really solve this problem and make sure that the homelessness problem gets addressed properly. And while there still may be having some other problems in other parts of the state, I think as far as Central Florida, I think we're making some significant progress.
Jason Garcia, what are your thoughts on that? Is it something which Central Florida can kind of stand up and say, look, we're taking the lead on this?
Sure. More needs to happen before it can really claim victory. Obviously, the fact that they're talking about it again is a very good thing, but it's also been a problem that has been acute in Central Florida for a long time now, and there have been a number of times where it has seemed to sort of capture sort of the attention of political leaders, and nothing sort of substantial has yet happened. So it does feel like there's momentum this time, and it's certainly the sort of thing Buddy Dyer is getting towards the end of his time as mayor, and sort of might be thinking about his long-term legacy, and if he can do something meaningful to address it, it'd be the thing he'd be best remembered for. So there is some hope, but there's a long way to go.
Just thinking about the debate, did we hear any of that kind of Black Lives Matter? Did any of that kind of filter through into what we heard on the debate stage last night?
Not terribly. That's sort of a trickier subject in a Republican debate, just because the primary voters are generally on the Republican primary more concerned about some different issues. So I think you will see quite a bit of that in the general election, and you may see some of it even in some of the Democratic debates when they start going. But I would expect that to be more of a general election issue.
Mm-hmm. I think Scott Walker maybe answered one question at it at one point, saying that basically it comes down to training and that everybody should be treated fairly. Mm-hmm. I want to just pivot back to something we were talking about before. Trump is kind of inescapable, and we have a caller on the line now. I'm going to go to Debbie in Lake County. Debbie, you've got a comment about the debate last night. What's on your mind?
Yes, I do. As far as the debate, none of the candidates I feel represent women, and Donald Trump in particular, is just in the way that he has approached women. I would not see him. I don't see him lasting as a candidate. But they really didn't ask anything that was, substantive, or things that I care about, like the economy, global warming. It was basically, to me, a three-ring circus of, these going to be the Republican candidate, well, possibly not Trump. But, I would not vote for any of them.
Well, Debbie, thank you so much for your call. I do appreciate it. We were talking before about Carly Fiorina. Frank Torres, just quickly, I wonder if, having her on the debate stage might sort of shift some of the emphasis on what gets discussed in the debate maybe next time around.
Absolutely. I think we mentioned diversity. Jason mentioned diversity earlier. I think having her on that stage definitely sort of brings that sort of flavor into the race and that needed element. The Democrats are often calling Republicans anti-women, and I believe having a qualified, respectable Republican candidate on that stage certainly does something to help the cause.
Rheta Peoples, are you anticipating that, we're going to see more nuanced views and perhaps a sort of more broader base of questions next time around when we get to the debate?
Yes, I think we will see that, especially once the Democrats get on stage. I think we'll start seeing things that matter to women, things that matter to, for Black Lives Matter. We'll start seeing a lot of different things come to light once the debate starts shaking out fairly.
Mm-hmm. Just going to take one more call here. We've got Daniel on the line. Daniel, you're on the air. You want to make a comment about mental illness and homelessness. What's on your mind?
Yes, I'm a physician. I've been here in Central Florida for almost 30 years. We have completely eliminated what used to be a pretty good public health structure for treating people with chronic mental illness. And that whole role has fallen on the police. Most of those people are homeless, And I've observed this many times. The police do not have adequate training for dealing with people with mental illness. They're invariably incarcerated. The jails have become our only long-term facilities with long-term beds for the mentally ill, and the treatment that they provide is woefully substandard. You know, I think we need to look at the source of a substantial part of this problem, substance abuse and chronic mental illness, and if we're not willing to commit actual tax dollars to provide real care facilities, there is no way out.
Daniel, thank you so much for your call. I do appreciate it. Some thoughts there on how the police are basically acting as a substitute or backup, medical care professionals in some case. Thank you so much for your call, Daniel. Just getting back to the issue of the Sarasota police officer real quick, Rheta Peoples, is that what we're seeing here? Do you think maybe police officers stretch a little bit beyond their limits in terms of what they're able to deal with, the training perhaps?
Absolutely. I think protect and serve, is becoming a joke with some of these officers that we're seeing. Not all of them, obviously, but some officers are really just outright disgusting. And the Sarasota officer, feeding peanuts to the homeless man was just absolutely embarrassing and shameful.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. When we come back, we're going to talk about black bears. In the wild, they're shy of people, but once they develop a taste for the suburbs, rummaging through neighborhood trash cans for food, they're a different beast altogether. And after a spate of bear-human interactions, the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission reopens the bear hunt for the first time in 20 years. Well, are you a hunter? Have you got a permit to go hunting? Did the FWC get it right? Or is it a mistake to try and control the bear population by hunting? Join us, 1-866-338-5252. Intersection returns after a short break.
Support for 90.7 News comes from OUC, the reliable one, with a mission to weave sustainability into everything they do, from building Florida's first community solar farm to finding where your home can be more energy efficient. At OUC, this is what sustainability looks like. More information at OUC.com.
We've made it to Friday. Good morning. I'm Nicole Creston, and you're listening to Intersection, taking your calls live on 90.7 News.
Global warming is turning the Arctic literally into a melting pot. I'm Ira Flatow. Join me on Science Friday for a look at grizzly bears and other climate change hybrids. Plus, the Sci-Fi Book Club reboots. We are reading The Soul of a New Machine and the first 3D printed pill. All on Science Friday from PRI.
Join us for Science Friday beginning at 2 o'clock.
Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. With me in the studio, Rheta Peoples from the Florida Sun, Jason Garcia from Florida Trend Magazine, and Frank Torres, Orlando Political Observer. You can join the conversation too, 1-866-338-5252. Taking your calls now about the upcoming bear hunt. Well, the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission spent months getting feedback from residents about its bear hunt. It's all part of a plan to manage black bears, which number more than 3,000. And they got a lot of protests from residents and environmentalists. Here's Chuck O'Neill from the League of Women Voters of Florida talking on this program this week.
That this is not being done correctly. The FWC has not gone through the steps necessary to make this a good hunt, and to sell permits to anyone who has $100 and a rifle is a recipe for disaster.
We spoke to a bear hunter too. He said he's not going to get a permit, and he thinks many of the hunters that do will not have the experience.
I'm not scared of any bear in the state of Florida in the woods, because they're going to run. You get in the neighborhoods where they're used to running people off, running animals off, they've lost the fear of man. That's a whole, to me, a whole other species of bear, because it's just not the same as a wild bear.
Well, there are plenty of people who do want to go out and hunt a bear. Permits went on sale on Monday, and by now there are over 1,400 sold to aspiring bear hunters, including Ted Nugent. He wants a permit, and they can only kill 320 bears. Are we on track to having more hunters than there are bears in all of Florida by the time hunting season starts in October? Is this a step in the right direction for managing bears? Will it help reduce the number of maulings and nuisance bears in the suburbs? You can join us. Call 1-866-338-5252. Rheta Peoples, let me ask you this. Did the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission spend enough time getting input from residents in Florida?
No, absolutely not. I think the last thing Florida needs is bullets flying through the air, you know, whether it's at human beings or bears. You know, and Lake Mary black bears have their own little Facebook page and they're speaking out about it. So, you know, I think it's interesting, but it's the wrong move. It's definitely the wrong move.
Do you see it having some kind of impact on reducing the bear human encounters, though, this cull, this hunt?
No, I don't. You know, I think bears don't want to interact with humans and so forth. So, you know, as the caller said, they would bears would run. So why would we shoot them if they're going in the opposite direction? For self-defense, I think that's a whole different story. But I don't think they're overpopulating the communities to that point where we need to start hunting them.
Well, what about down the track, Rheta Peoples? Do you anticipate the FWC might have another think about it after October and perhaps roll back its plans?
I sure hope so. And I hope that they're able to, you know, maybe stop the permit selling and so forth. I know that there's an organization out there that wanted to purchase all of the permits to stop the hunt. But I don't know what's going on with that at this point.
Well, do you see bears in your neighborhood? Will this hunt help reduce the number of suburban bear sightings? Join the conversation, 1-866-338-5252. Are you planning to join the hunt? Give us a call, 1-866-338-5252. Going to go to a call now. We're going to Dan. Dan is calling from Daytona Beach. Dan, you're on the air.
Hi, Dan. Well, I'd just like to say that one of the most important things to come from this program is not necessarily reducing the number of bears, but what it is actually going to do is change the relationship of bear to people. Right now, bears have no fear of us, and it's actually detrimental for them. They come too close to our houses, and regardless of where we put our houses, bears being scavengers would come to find them. Mm-hmm. So it's very important that we reestablish a different relationship between humans and bears. And I think ultimately it'll increase the bear population because they will abscond from human interaction.
Well, let me ask you this, Dan. Do you see bears in your neck of the woods? Are they a problem sort of fossicking through the trash and the like?
Oh, certainly. I live over here in Daytona Beach, and they'll come all the way from the Ocala National Forest to come find food from, you know, from the suburbs. So it doesn't matter how much room we give them. They'll come to find us. Mm-hmm. And we recently had a situation up here where a lady was going out to her trash can in Ormond Lakes, and a bear stood up on her, and her husband had to shoot it. Now, had this bear at some point in the past few years been maybe felt some hunting pressure and felt, you know, the need to stay away from people, this might not have happened, especially when we talk about our children. So I think for the safety of all, it's not necessarily the bear numbers, but it's imprinting a different relationship on the bear that you need to be wary of humans and not see them as, you know, potential food sources.
Dan, thank you so much for your call. I do appreciate it. Dan from Daytona Beach. Going to take another call now from Altamont Springs. Steve. Steve is calling from Altamont Springs. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning.
How are you doing?
Very well. I just can't understand why they would just say because the bears are intruding on our turf that it's time to start killing them. When you kill an adult bear, you've made an orphan out of baby bears. And how are they going to live and survive and thrive? And, you know, I can understand nuisance alligators and predatory snakes and things of that nature, but bears are normally a docile animal. I used to live in Sanford and west of I-4 over near Wakiva Park, in that area, and they had bears roaming freely all over the place, including the RV park where we were residing at the time. I resided there for about 5 years and never had any problems with bears. And nobody ever said, oh, we got to start hunting bears because of that. It's just not making sense that we go out and kill bears. Did anybody out there watch Planet of the Apes? Do they understand what's going on? You don't just start killing animals, docile animals.
Steve, thank you so much for your call. Do appreciate it. Steve from Altamont Springs thinks the bears should not be killed. It's going to create orphans. I'm going to take one more call now on this bear issue. Tim is calling from Winter Park. Tim, you're on the air.
Hi, first-time caller. Love the show.
Thank you so much.
I am absolutely going to get a bear hunting permit. Absolutely. After hearing your guest, and I really thought it was adorable. we shouldn't shoot a bear because they have a Facebook page? Are you serious right now?
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, bear is delicious, and there's plenty of them, and there's no reason not to harvest a few.
Tim, if I could jump in, you've eaten pigs
and things of that nature. What's the problem? Actually, plucking a bear from the woods.
Tim, can I just ask you? You've eaten bear?
Absolutely. It's
what's it like?
If you have it in a stew, it's not as gamey as you would think. It really isn't as tough as long as you actually know how to prepare the meat.
Mm-hmm.
But it's delicious. I highly recommend you try it.
What about some of the concerns, though, Tim? I mean, some folks have said, well, there's going to be a bunch of hunters there, and we're up to 1,400 permits already. I guess some folks have a fear or a thought that maybe the woods are going to be, you know, flush with hunters and they're going to outnumber the bears. Is that a concern as a hunter?
No, it's absolutely ridiculous. Take a look at how many deer hunting permits go out every single year. It's going to dwarf that number, and no one gets hurt. Mm-hmm. Hunters are far more responsible with firearms than most other people.
Tim, I appreciate your call. Thank you so much for calling in. Okay, we'll take one more call on the bears from Terry. Terry, you're calling from Altamont Springs. What's on your mind?
Yes, hi. I just wanted to call in and express my disapproval of the hunt that FWC has done. Unless bears are telepathic and a bear in the city can communicate somehow with a bear in the forest and know that, oh, gee, they're hunting us now, I need to get out of the, you know, humans' neighborhood, I think it's a very poor way to manage our bear population and especially to manage bear-human interaction.
Mm-hmm.
I think the FWC, I wish that they had been doing their mandate for years, which is to educate and encourage people of the right ways to be bear smart.
Terry, I appreciate your call, but your phone is kind of cutting out, but thank you so much for calling in. Jason Garcia, there's been a lot of criticism from environmentalists and some of the folks we heard just on the air now opposing the hunt. Also, there's an accusation that the hunt is politically motivated. Do you see some blowback for Florida officials over this bear hunt?
Well, it's hard to say because, as you see just from the callers, there's pretty strongly held views on both sides. My hunch is actually probably not. Hunting and gun rights in Florida are in a lot of the state almost sacrosanct. Hunting is very popular here, and it's got a very strong, active constituency. So my suspicion is, if I had to predict, I don't think this is the sort of thing that's likely to blow back on politicians, except maybe in isolated local cases.
Mm-hmm. And we've seen the level of passion generated over the hunting with the furor about Cecil the Lion. Of course, there's a Florida connection to this story. The South Florida vacation home owned by dentist Walter Palmer was vandalized, and the words "Lion Killer" sprayed on the garage door and "Pigs Trotters" sprinkled on the lawn. Frank Torres, I wonder if there's any way to talk about hunting and leave aside the emotion.
I don't think so. I think you're always going to have people that are very sympathetic towards the animal population. I think people have just an emotional bond. They learn more about these creatures and get to find out what their communities are like. There are so much well-produced media out there regarding the lives of this wildlife. So you're always going to have a group of people that are particularly affectionate towards the animal population. And whenever the population control issue comes up, regardless of their actions, you know, you'll recall the black bears had several altercations with humans in Seminole County. But there's always going to be some sort of connection or affectionate connection to these animals before you take measures like this one.
Mm-hmm. Take one more call on the bears. Kathy, you're calling from DeLand. What's on your mind about bears?
Good morning. Thank you for listening to me. I actually live in Glenwood, which is an area that was used by the FWC to study the efficacy of bear cans, mm-hmm. bear-proof cans, I should say, and because we have one of the highest bear incident logs in the state. And so that was why our area was chosen for the study.
Right.
And at the end of the two-year study, they found that bear issues were reduced by 91% because of the use of the bear cans.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's really trash that's attracting the bears. If you have an open restaurant, the bears are going to come. If you close the restaurant, they will go elsewhere. And I'm finding it difficult to understand why the state does not try using bear cans. I realize that they're a more expensive alternative than hunting.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me if you stop the problem in the neighborhoods, then you reduce the the issue of bear-human or bear-dog interactions.
Kathy, also, thank you so much for your call. I do appreciate it. We're kind of running short on time, so we're going to have to go, but appreciate those calls, and we'll talk more about bears in the future, I'm sure, as we get closer to hunting season. Well, finally, the list is out. Where is the best party school in Florida?
They're going to nail us no matter what we do. So we might as well have a good time. Toga, 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 toga.
Well, according to the Princeton Review, it's the University of Florida coming in at number 14 on the national list, followed by FSU at number 15. The review also ranked the University of Central Florida number 6 for universities with the best health services, and Rollins College, for those folks who are fortunate enough to go to Rollins, the most beautiful college campus. I've been joined by Retta People. She writes for the Florida Sun. Retta, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Jason Garcia is an associate editor with Florida Trend Magazine. Thank you so much, Jason.
Yeah, thank you.
And Frank Torres from the Orlando Political Observer. Thanks as always, Frank.
Thank you so much.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Production assistance for this week's show from Amy Green and Nicole Kristen. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Do join us next Tuesday morning at 9. We'll be talking about redistricting in more depth and the special session. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.